Today's pod is an all-time. A lot of jaw love and what real love means. Dirk Nowitzki, his career. Book is out. We talked to Dirk, man. What else do you need to know? And life advice with another Dirk story. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Hulu Plus Live TV. Looking for a better way to watch live TV? Stream your favorite sports and shows on over 95 live channels with Hulu Plus Live TV. Get access to Hulu's entire streaming library, Disney Plus and ESPN Plus, all in one plan. Start your free trial of Hulu Plus Live TV today. Live TV plan required. Restrictions apply. Access content from each service separately. Learn more at Hulu.com. Where else do you start today except for one of the most electric guards in the NBA? Huge night for him, and that's Markelle Fultz returning to the Orlando Magic the first time over a year. We will ask Rudy about that maybe some other time this week. Now, we have to start with Ja Morant, who has now become appointment viewing. And it's awesome to see this. It's awesome to see it play out nationally where somebody that I think all of us just enjoy so much. He goes for 52 last night against the Spurs. A career high for him. First ever 50-point game in Memphis history. That's after he set his own career high this past weekend against the Bulls with 46. So he's on an absolute tear. Last night's game, he had 13 straight in the fourth quarter. And it was actually still kind of a game with San Antonio. I don't think he missed a shot in the fourth quarter on top of everything else. He hit a bunch of threes. He had a dunk on Jakob Poeltl where people were afraid Poeltl was going to retire after the fact. And by the way, Poeltl's not terrible. It was one of those vicious jaw dunks where there's another level that he gets to. I don't know how many of you remember the Tom Chambers dunk over Mark Jackson. It was basically the dunk for not only that season, but also the video game, because they basically were like, there was this move you could play in the game where if you took off with Tom Chambers, you would just go up higher than everybody else, which seems a little ridiculous because Jordan was playing at the time too. And the reason he went up so high on that is because Mark Jackson helped kind of lift him up beyond what a guy would normally do, any human would do. And Ja has more moments right now that don't seem human than maybe anybody in the league. And I don't know. I don't know who keeps track of the non-human movements, but that's what we have with Ja. His attacking is relentless. I don't think anybody splits a double team better than he does. You think you have him just walled off. You think that there's no way he can get through, and then he gets through you. You think that he's done on his drive and the angle is cut off and he's going to have to turn and kick it back out to somebody else. Then he takes kind of this Euro Ginobili step and then gets the ball up and around and flips it from a different angle that you weren't expecting. And it happens all the time. And he plays with this viciousness too, which I love because we want all of our stars to have confidence, right? We want them to have a little bit of attitude, maybe a lot of attitude, but we don't want so much confidence and so much attitude that it detracts from the actual game and in those winning moments. And he appears to have the perfect combination of all these elements that you want in the personality of a superstar. Very early in the season, when they started putting this together and going on a roll and you started to see this big statistical jump from Ja. I mean, here's just one example. PER isn't always the best, but it's really telling for perimeter players. His PER has jumped from like, hey, you know, it's pretty good as Ja, like mid-teens, 16, 17. to 25. It's jumped like 10 points, 8 or 9, 10 points, depending on how you track the last 2 years. But there also was a joy that this team had where not only did they feel connected, which is very important in basketball. I use it when I'm super complimentary of basketball teams. They're connected. They know everybody's role. Everybody seems to be kind of happy in their role. And this is a Memphis team that's deep too and has a lot of pieces, but there's a joy and attitude that they have where they're, whether it was talking shit to LeBron James, just saying, hey, we're not afraid of you anymore, going into New York City and being like, whatever. Like, this is, you guys want to mess with us? Go ahead, because we think we're that good. And they're knocking on some doors here. Now, when the MVP race comes through, Ja's going to now having guys like me, or some that are still on television, going to be saying Ja's the clear MVP. And what's the rule we hate more than anything else is that when somebody makes these arguments, it says it's not even close. The whole point of this MVP race this season, as I've said numerous times, is that it is actually really close, but it's not to be dismissive of Ja. It's just that he's the next guy up for that. He now becomes the unanimous dude. And there is something to be said of having popular opinion, and certainly the people on television that have MVP votes. It's almost sometimes where people like kind of the mob mentality could kind of shift in a certain direction. So to have that momentum is actually important for you potentially winning an MVP. But if we look over the timeline, Durant had a stretch, Steph had a stretch, Jokic has had a stretch where he's still very much in this thing. Embiid then kind of took over for Jokic, where it felt like it was the two of them. Embiid is still very much in it as well. And then DeRozan was the most recent guy, in just the last week plus, a little before the All-Star break, a little bit after it, where it's like, now DeRozan's actually the guy now. And maybe he is, and maybe he gets votes. But if you were going to look at some of the Ja stuff, you could say, well, he's missed 14 games, but he's played more games than Embiid. He's going to play more games than Durant. I think Steph's kind of out of the conversation at this point. Giannis gets criminally overlooked, even though his numbers are basically identical to what he's done in previous years, and he's going to have a career high in win shares and PER. And by the way, Giannis is also hitting his free throws again. So I think Ja is in this conversation, but you know, when you can look at some of the standing stuff, you're like, well, what if Chicago's a one seed? It's DeRozan. Well, Memphis has a better record right now than Philadelphia in Chicago, which is my point of really saying have an open mind about all of this stuff. Because as somebody that did do this for a long time and knows what it's like to sit in those pre-show meetings and know that the sexiness that next morning, be like, hey, what do you want to say about Ja? And you're like, well, this is where I always sucked at it. And I'd go, he's in the MVP conversation. I think Memphis is really good. And I fucking love Ja Morant. What do you want me to say? It's like, well, could you say he's definitely the MVP? And I'd be like, well, no, I don't really believe that. Like, we still have ways to go here. We got like 20 games. Do you want to say Memphis is going to win the title? No, I don't. I'm not going to say they're incapable, but that would seem really dismissive of maybe the deepest top of contenders we've had in a really long time. Okay, do you want to say that Ja's maybe better than any other point guard? No. I mean, he might be, but I still think I'm probably going to take Steph. All right, would you say that you would take Ja to start your team over anyone else right now? I don't know that I would do that either. I really like him. I think it's clear the first 5 minutes of this monologue, I really like him, but I don't know that I would do those things. And the thing is none of that shit really matters. It's sexy. It gets the attention the next day. Everybody's in a hurry to kind of do some of these things, but none of that stuff really matters. And I'm going to make a point here. When I've talked college football over the years, I probably seem more forgiving for certain programs and certain coaches than others would. Because my grade or my gauge of who you are as a program and as coach is, are you in the mix to play in a conference championship? And does that mean that you're in the mix then to be in the playoff? And that means if you're sort of flirting with that playoff mix and maybe not even get in or win your conference championship, if you're one of those programs that feels like they're flirting with it for about 10 weeks of the season, then that's really the best that you can do unless you have the standard of, say, an Alabama or a Clemson or maybe even now Georgia. But Georgia's a good example because Georgia plays in a national championship, loses an epic game to Tua. You know, they're hanging around, but they still got Bama in the way. But I'm looking at it going, how are you guys knocking this program? Like, they're right there talent-wise. And I know people didn't like Kirby until he won a national championship, or at least they were frustrated by him until he won it. But I'm thinking, this is all you can really ask for. They are in the mix, and this is very real. This is a real thing. It's not the flashy things. This is real, and this matters. And it might work out for them. It might not. But the fact that they're in this group of teams is really what you're hoping to do when you're building a program. And that's what's important, the real stuff. Memphis has a real guy. I don't know how long that list is. I usually would argue that it's like 6 or 7 players that can absolutely change the course of your franchise. That list is rarely 10 players long. I think it's usually a lot shorter than that, but we'll flirt with different things. But even if you look at the timeline of, say, a Trae Young comes in. Okay, is it going to be good? Is it going to be a disaster? It was way too negative for him early on. Remember the summer league and all that kind of stuff. And then you could see how talented he is. It's like, okay, he's scoring. But then last year it felt real because they beat the Sixers. They play in the Eastern Conference Finals. And now you're starting to feel like if you're a Hawks fan, you have something to build on. Same thing happened with Giannis. Giannis took a little while. And it was like, okay, there's some exciting plays and some cool videos that break out, but how good of a basketball player is he? And then he transitions into, holy shit, I think we really have something here. And Milwaukee, despite their frustrations and the playoff exits, certainly the one against Miami a couple of years ago, you at least had a building block, somebody that changes who you are as a franchise, the culture, all these things that we could throw around a lot, but you know what? Like, culture is actually important. It's just that people pretend that they can just invent it out of thin air. So whatever the sexy things that you hear about Ja, that you're going to hear. Like, you're going to hear a ton of it. And he deserves all of those things. But the way I would look at it is saying, Memphis is real. They have one of these franchise-changing players. And honestly, that's way more important than some of the sexy headlines where I think it'd be really aggressive statements about Ja. And as sexy as those all may be, they're not nearly as important as now looking at Memphis as a real team, a team you have to take serious in the playoffs, a player like Ja that can close out maybe anybody with his offensive attacking style, a deep team that seems to love playing with each other. And it really feels like a team that, you know, I'm always a little cautious about young teams in the playoff. The history there isn't great, but it may feel like they've jumped the line here a little bit. And that very well could be the case with whatever happens with Phoenix. If Golden State doesn't have enough size, if Draymond doesn't come back and look as good as he did the first half of the season, considering all the games he's missed, all the East teams that I keep changing my mind about, not wanting to give up on some and completely dismissing others. The most important part of the Memphis conversation is that they are real. They need to be taken that way, even though that's nearly as not as much fun as some of the other things you're going to hear this week. This episode is brought to you by Arby's, the perfect sandwich. Let me think. Buffalo chicken sandwich is done right, can change your life. I've never been the same in the best way possible when I experienced my first one. Also loving to travel, I've had gyros, also known as gyros. I think if you go to Arby's and you order a gyro, they're not going to judge you. And that's what I like about them. Nice chicken, perfectly sauced, butter lettuce, good body. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what Arby's has. They have more than you may even realize. Get out there and explore. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. This episode is supported by State Farm. So look, a little rock hit your dude's windshield on the highway. And at first you're like, what is that? I'm like, oh, it's just a little mark. Nope. Now by the end of the ride, it's a big crack. And it'd been a while. So I check out the State Farm app. I go, hey, this is what happened. And the funny thing is I was like, do I want to go app first or do I call? Old school guy, probably should call. I was like, let's check out the app. Not only did it take a minute to get done, they set up the glass replacement. They told me the estimate ahead of time, said, you want to go ahead with it? And I was like, now I understand. It's all in front of me, all done. I don't even have to talk to anybody. That's how efficient the insurance game has become. But really, the only words you need to remember are, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm has options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, just like I did, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to somebody. The app was so good, I didn't even need to do that. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Learn more at statefarm.com. Dirk Nowitzki joins us. Book is The Great Nowitzki, Basketball and the Meaning of Life by Thomas Pletzinger. So let's do this, man. Let's go back where this book also goes back to the mid-90s. You're a teenager, Germany. You're 7 feet tall. You're working out with Holger. And you're trying to figure out this basketball thing. Did you have any idea? Did you know, like, what were those years like prior to the Hoop Summit and then ultimately the draft? Like, when you're going, wait, am I actually this good?
I mean, it was a strange time meeting Holger. And, you know, I wasn't quite, I'm German. So I think by nature, we're a little more negative and we have doubts. And so I wasn't sure whether it was good enough and even to play in the NBA or let alone make it. But, you know, Holger was big in my life there. When I met him when I was 15, 16, he taught me how to play, how to shoot, how to move. He was sort of my mentor that I needed at the time to get through school and get to the next level. And he showed me how to work hard. And so, you know, a couple of weeks ago at the Jersey retirement, when I said to him that how much he meant to me, and without him, I probably would have not made it to the stage. I really meant that. He was vital in my life and my career. And I met him at a great time where, you know, the teenager years are really tough. As you know, you have all these things in your mind and you want to do and that gets you off track. And so he was there and made sure that I was always focused and got to live my dream. So I do owe him a lot. And even my first couple of years in the league when things weren't going well at all, My first year was super tough, the lockout year, and he was always a phone call away. So it was tough times, obviously, going through. But looking back at now, these years were really vital for me to understand and how to work, how to be a professional, and how to make it in the league. So those were vital lessons.
So 16, you're with Wurzburg, right? But it's a men's team, but it was a second division. And then I was reading about it, like they would have beers and you would just be like, I just want to have one because I don't want to be like an idiot kid. I mean, that had to be just an odd dynamic to be 16 now thrown into this man's world.
Yeah. So we played in the men's team, and some of them were like, a few of them were professionals that they were paid decently, and some of them were students. We had a farmer on the team that was running a full-on farm with horses, and during the day he was doing all his wheat and stuff. So I mean, it was it's a great dynamic. The club sports, it's just a different feeling than just the system over here where you play in school and then maybe AAU. But that's the system that's in Europe with you join a club, and when you're good enough, you move up and you play with basically grown men. And it was a crazy time, man. I mean, I was 15. I was soaking it all in. I played with some of my guys that I've watched for years now on the same team, and they were having fun. Obviously, they were professionals, but no, they were never going to go to the next level. So they were competing, but also having fun at the same time, going out after every game on the weekend. And so it was a fun time to go through, and I tried to stay focused as much as I could.
So you went to, actually, because you were starting to travel a little bit more, you saw the 96 Olympics in person, right? Like you just went to go check it out. What was that kind of feeling? Knowing the dream team 4 years prior was probably maybe the first experience you got to maybe even thinking about basketball.
Yeah, so 92 Olympics changed a lot for me. You know, I always tell the story, Charles had number 14 in the Olympics, and then I changed my number 14. And then that's why it had a big impact on my basketball career and how I followed it and how I got excited about it. And in 96, I happened to be in Georgia for like a little high school tournament.
The Peach Jam?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I was there, and I think it was in Savannah, Georgia that year. And then on the way back, we flew from Atlanta. So I got to go to one or two games in the Olympics, and I was sitting all the way up in the Georgia Dome, I think I remember, and just watching that. So I was a huge basketball fan in the 90s, try to catch all NBA games at night, you know, get up, watch the finals, watch the All-Star game, you know, just I was all in on basketball. It was a dream of mine to play there and watch as many games as I could. There was a time, I think, in the 90s where I knew every player on every roster. I mean, that's how deep I was into it. And it was a great time to me in the 90s where amazing, you know, the music, the movies, the NBA style, how they played. I mean, the 90s to me is the best ever.
So you win the MVP in the under 18 tournament. You know, Holger's starting to just get in your ear a little bit more, being like, hey, this is real. I know there's a bunch of different things, like you graduate high school around this time. Patino was on the road. Like Patino at that point is going to be running the Celtics. So what happened in this secret workout? Because I'm from New England and lived in Boston for a while. And I want to get to the Dallas part, obviously. But there's so many people that still think that you were supposed to be a Celtic.
That is true. That did happen. I met up with Rick, and he was on his vacation. And I'm not sure all this is actually legal. but I met up with Rick, and we did a private workout, and he really liked what he saw. And so I guess he said, we're going to draft this European kid, but they had pick number 10. And, you know, at the time, I think it was a little risky because I wasn't even sure whether I was going to go to the NBA because I wasn't sure my body was ready. You know, like we mentioned earlier, I only played the second division in Germany. And so I still was thinking about maybe going to college or staying in Europe for a few more years. And so that was a very risky route to take for some of these NBA clubs that were actually interested in me. And then, I guess Mavericks and Donnie Nelson at the time was an assistant coach of the Hoop Summit when I played there. And so I guess, you know, he liked what he saw there. And so I actually never ended up falling to the 10th spot. So they traded for me from Milwaukee, drafted me. They had a deal going, and then it was actually a great move. They got for Tractor Trailer and somebody that got me and Steve Nash at the same time on the same day, and that obviously ended up being a great move for us, and that really set us up for the next couple of years. But you know, I think Boston is a great, great sports town, and I think I would have had a lot of fun there too. But I think it worked out for myself.
Yeah, I think it worked out for you too. If I can just back up though, before we get to the Hoop Summit part, because there's two things. You had to enter the military, right, for service. Mm-hmm. Like, it's your duty at that age. And mm-hmm. in the book, you're clearly miserable because you're not playing any basketball. You're 7 feet. You're walking around. You're like, what am I doing? But then you ended up playing against Barkley in some exhibition. So what yes. happened when you played against Charles Barkley?
So they were on a Nike promotion tour, and it was actually called the Hoop Heroes. And they brought a team with Gary Payton, Vin Baker, Scottie Pippen, Jason Kidd, Charles Barkley. They came over and did a promotional tour, played two games in Germany and one in Paris. And that was super exciting. I was done with basic training in my army. So I was in a sports company for the rest of 8 months where I had time. I could practice every day. And so I was able to go to those games and be a part of that. And you know, just it was a wide open game. There was no really defense played. There was the gyms were packed, so it was just a fun promotional basketball thing. And of course, you know, there was wide open. So I had a few jumpers and I had a few dunks. And that's where Charles, afterwards, the press conference, said the famous lines that he can get me into Auburn, and if I wanted to. And you know, that of course at the time, you know, Charles is my hero. I'm wearing number 14 because he had 14 in the Olympics, and so to just to hear those words, I was in awe and super shocked. And obviously things didn't work out that way. I didn't go to Auburn. I decided then to go straight to the league, and that worked out that way. But just to see those guys up close and see how they play, how they prepare, and just to be on the court with them was a huge step for me and a super awe moment.
But didn't he also ask you, like, what the hell are you doing in the military? He didn't understand it, right?
Yeah, there was that, you know. Yeah, no, you didn't understand at the time. I think it was mandatory for Germany at the time to go in when you're done with high school to go in the military. So I did a 10-month stint. That's why if I would have gone to college, I would have been an older, obviously, freshman in college. So I was already, by the time I came to the NBA, I was already 20 at that because I had a year in the Army. So, but yeah, nobody really understand that fact. But you know, the good thing about the Army, I only had to do 2 months of basic training, which was every day. And that was a grind. That's what's described in the book. And then the other 8 months, I was able to train. I was still living home. You know, that's when I really started to be a professional. I was able to train in the morning, train at night, and really go after it. And I learned a lot in those 7-8 months. I was able to train with Holger on a daily basis. So that really took me over the top.
No, you're right. The Holger being with you at every stop, And the Hoop Summit, it's funny because he's like behind the bench and you're like, what the hell's going on? But Donnie Nelson, the Donnie, you know, Jr. is on the staff and it's in their backyard. And so all these things are happening so fast. You're still, like you say, here in the book. And I remember at the time, I was like, is this guy even coming over? Because I can't express, you know, 20 plus years ago to the audience that's younger, we're like, who's this fucking guy? Like, what's his deal? Like, is because we just weren't ready for it. You know, it was the beginning that the European explosion, the Skidish Vili's going five overall because you turned out to be so good. Like, this stuff hadn't happened.
You remember that?
Oh, come on, man. Do you ever talk to Skidish Vili? You should probably be thinking.
I've talked to Skeeter for a while, but no, I haven't seen him in a minute.
Okay, so how close was it for real for you potentially going to Stanford or Cal?
So I did a trip while I was in the Army. They allowed me to make a trip, and I did a little college visit trip, and I visited Stanford, I visited Cal, and I visited Kentucky, actually, with Tubby Smith, coach at the time. And I really loved what I saw. I mean, I A lot of guys that I played with over the years, they always say their best time was a couple of years in college. So, you know, part of me regrets a little bit not trying it at least for 1 year. But I think for my development, I'm not sure it would have been good. You know, in college back then, was still the big guys need to lift weights and they need to go on the block. And there was not, I think that would have been not great for my development. So I think I did, thinking back, it was the right decision to go right in the league and go to the Nelsons, who, as you know, had a different philosophy. You know, they were already, Donnie always saw that the sport different. You know, it's smaller guys, everybody can shoot, everybody needs to use their skill, and it was a mismatch master, and so that was perfect. That played in my hands. So I think if I would have gone anywhere else or college or even another NBA team, I'm not sure my skills would have developed the way they did in Dallas. So that was just a perfect fit for me and my skill set early on in my career.
Okay, so we go through the trade, and then ironically enough, the other pieces, they go grab Nash because Donnie wants you to play wide open. You know, and you're right, mm-hmm. because if it was somebody else, they're probably mad you're not on the block every time. And yeah. I mean, credit to Holger for understanding that you're a new power forward. You're this new thing that we're not even ready for yet. And then you bring mm-hmm. in Nash, who, you know, wasn't getting a ton of run with Phoenix. So Donnie's like, look, it's going to all work out. And then, as you had said, you thought about maybe staying at the higher division in Germany or maybe even playing in, like, I think it was where you could maybe Madrid or, you know, maybe one of the top leagues. And then I'll come over, I'll get my body right. And then everybody's mm-hmm. like, no, we're doing it. We're doing it. You have a meeting, y'all hang out. Sounds like you had some beers. You're like, all right, I'm coming to Dallas. And then the lockout happens. And so you're basically hanging out, waiting. And then you get a notice being like, get to Dallas in 24 hours. And that was your rookie year. How hard was that?
I mean, it was nuts. That whole period. So I wasn't sure whether I was good enough to come. So right after the draft, Dallas flew me in. And I got to meet Steve and Mike and you know, some of the teammates. And they basically said, hey, we're not a great team. You can develop. There's no pressure at the beginning. Come on over. And before I had to fly back to Germany after the draft, I had to give them a decision. And those were some sleepless nights because, I'm a negative guy from, you know, in my personality. I wasn't sure whether it was good enough. And so there were some sleepless nights. And then finally, before I flew back to Germany, I told them, okay, Steve and Mike were so nice. I'm going to try it. And then literally the lockout happened a week later. So I didn't sign my contract yet. So I was still eligible to play in Germany. So I went back home. We couldn't go in our NBA gym anyways. We couldn't practice together. We couldn't scrimmage there. And so I went back home. I trained with Holger. I played for my team, who now in the meantime got promoted. So we were in the first division now in Germany. And so the competition was good or better than in the second division. And I was able to live at home with my parents. And I felt comfortable. And then one day, sure enough, every day, you know, we didn't really have the internet back then. So I was checking on, I'm not sure if that's the thing, it's called a video text. So on your TV, you can click this thing and then the news come up. And so every morning I check the news on this video text thing on my TV. And one morning I wake up and it says NBA season saved. And now about snapped. I was like, oh my God, I got so nervous and anxious. Sure enough, that day Donnie called and said, hey, It's time to report. And I remember I was so nervous and almost frightened to come over now and have this starting. So it was a tough time in my life. And then coming over and then, you know, basically had, 10 days, not even a training camp. I didn't even know all the plays. I didn't know all the defensive coverages. And then, boom, started the season, right? So It was tough. And then, as you know, it was a 50-game season in 2.5 months. So there was a stretch where we had 6 games in 8 days, you know, in 6 different cities. And coming from Germany, I had 1 game a weekend. So it was a different world. You know, my language wasn't great. But I didn't understand all the English yet. So life was full of challenges. And it was a tough season for me to get going. But you know, by the end of the first season, we were kind of out of the playoffs, and old Nell said, hey, you know, I'm going to put you back in the starting lineup and, you know, get some confidence going, get some games. There's no pressure now. And And that was big for me. I always remember the game in Phoenix. I had 28 points in my rookie year. And, you know, that showed me, hey, that gave me a lot of confidence. If you work hard and you work hard this summer, I had summer league, I had European championship. And if you keep working on your game, I think you can actually make it in this league. And so going through it at the time was tough. You know, missed home. It was the culture shock that the game was so different, more physical and faster than I'd ever imagined. Going through really sucked. But looking back now, it was a very, very important time in my life where I learned a lot and picked up a lot.
Because again, you know, I can't express this enough that you were a pioneer, not only as an international player, but your approach to the game. Who was the meanest to you as like a superstar vet who just thought you sucked? It was just so dismissive. There have to be a few good stories there.
Yeah, I mean, on my team, we had some old school guys that that obviously didn't really want the young German now all of a sudden to take over. So, you know, I had Cedric Ceballos on the team who was tough on me and always kicked my butt in practice every day. We had Robert Pack, who was a veteran at the time, and he actually had number 14. And so I kind of approached him like, can I get number 14? And he looked at me like I was out of my mind. And that's why 41 came about, because I just ended up flipping the numbers because he had 14. And he looked at me like I was absolutely crazy when I wanted 14. We had Hot Rod Williams, who was a legend and been around forever. I couldn't understand a word of his Louisiana accent, so he tried to teach me something. I'm just standing there looking around like, what is this guy telling me? I don't understand his accent. We had AC Green, who's been around for like 19 years at the time. So he was always tough for me. And so I remember my rookie year, you know, you had to do a couple of chores and carry the bags to the guys' rooms, which I don't think they do anymore now. And shoot around when we were in opposing big arenas. I always had, before we stretch, I had to put all the balls up. So AC Green is like, come here, it's time to stretch and shoot around. So I walk over, he's like, boom, he toe punts the ball somewhere in the 85th row of the arena. And I'm like, go get the ball. So I'm there, everybody's already stretching. I'm walking around the arena trying to chase balls. And, you know, there was some of that going on, the rookie stuff. But you know, it was something I had to go through. It wasn't really fun standing out in the freezing cold. We landed somewhere on the East Coast, and I'm doing the bags outside. I'm like shaking, getting the bags on the bus, delivering the guys' bags to their rooms. And that was my first year. That was it was interesting, and the guys, you know, picked their spots of being hard on me, but also trying to support me so I could still make it in this league.
How, I know he's one of your closest friends, Steve Nash, for him to come over, you know, look, he's from Canada, so it's not like he's from Germany here, but what was it like those first couple of years as you were both trying to figure out if you were good enough to be in this league? What was that friendship like that early?
Well, Steve obviously had a little bit of head start. He played college 4 years in Santa Clara, and then he got actually drafted by Phoenix, and he was behind KJ and behind Jason Kidd in Phoenix. Got to practice there, got to learn from these guys, but never really played that much. So then he got traded to Dallas on the same day I got drafted. And I don't know, we just had a similar background. He loved soccer, I loved soccer, so we had something to talk about. And, you know, we lived close to each other first couple of years, so we just developed this friendship. And worked super hard every night. I can remember on off nights, we went back to the gym. Let's play horse. Let's play one-on-one. Let's play all shooting games. And so it was a fun period of us hanging out, getting to know each other, having a friendship and a relationship. And then, you know, and also working hard. And then the Mavs were starting to get better. And the first time the Mavs were getting in the playoffs, and then Mark buying the team was a big turnaround, and all this started to happen my first couple years in this league. And it was a fun time. It was a fun time there, turning around the franchise with Mark, you know, getting us a new arena, getting us a new plane, you know, putting Dallas back on the basketball map after a shaky 90s decade where they were a little bit of a laughing stock. So that was a fun time to be there when we turned this franchise around. And Steve and Mike, who are still great friends of mine, were a big part of my early success and making me feel welcome and showing me how to be professional on, but also off the floor. How do you speak with the media? How do you act on community services? How you're in your community? And so all that I learned from these great professionals, and they're still great friends to this day.
Did you have any idea who this Ross Perot guy was who had previously owned the team before Mark? Like, I can't imagine somebody, an American, trying to explain to you who Ross Perot was.
I did not. So when I was drafted, the Nelsons came to Germany to see me, talk to me, meet me, see my background, and then fly me over to the States and kind of, get used to or meet some people in Dallas. So when the Nelsons came, actually Ross Perot flew in to Germany, to my hometown, to come for a press conference. And so that's when I met Ross for the first time, and super nice guy, super, super supportive. But at the time, I had no idea. I mean, we didn't have internet. I didn't know anything really about Dallas. I mean, all I've seen was a little bit of the TV show that my parents maybe watched, and I walked by. So I'm thinking I'm getting there. There's cowboys and, rodeos. And I actually got there, and I'm like, wow, this is a real city with like skyscrapers and everything. I had really no idea, no clue what to expect and how things are going to play out. So it was just like a leap in cold water and figure it out. So, but yeah, Ross was cool. And then of course, Mark bought my team in end of my second year. And then obviously everybody knows the relationship we developed and the friendship we developed after.
Yeah. Did other people think it was weird you were such good friends with the owner?
You know, I always say, Mark was young at the time. He was like 40s, whatever, when he bought the team. He was a super basketball fan. He had season tickets already before. And so he was a diehard fan. And he came to every practice. He came to every game. He flew with us on the plane, the road games. So I don't know. He was just always around. And he was a big fan. And so we had a lot of fun. And we played horse and one-on-one sometimes after practice. And we just developed a good relationship. And I always tell a story. Not a lot of team owners will come to their player's bachelor party, but he actually came to my bachelor party. So that I think that shows the relationship that we developed over those years. And I owe him so much, and how he always helped me off the floor if there was stuff with my family. And of course, there's normal issues. And he was always there for me, and I do owe Mark a lot, and we still have a great relationship.
So you make an All-Star team your fourth year in, All-Star every year from 2001 to 2012, and we all remember the 2006 NBA Finals. You're up 2-0, you're up 12 with 8.5 minutes to go, blow the lead, you lose 4 straight. What was that moment like for you as a player, knowing what you weren't able to accomplish?
You know, 06, I was super frustrated after Miami came back on us. But you know what? I felt like I was just getting into my prime. I felt like I was playing some of my best basketball. I'm thinking, we're going to be there every year now. You know, we got this. We're a good team. I can carry the team there. And I wasn't actually that frustrated after 06. Of course, it was super tough. But I felt good about where we were as a franchise and where I was at, playing at my highest level. So I kind of brushed it off like, okay, well, we'll be back. We'll make this again. And then we followed this up with an unbelievable season 06-07, which was my MVP year. We won 67 games. We're the number one seed, getting ready to roll. We had the Spurs number that year. I think we beat them 3 out of 4, which was our biggest rival. We felt good about that matchup. So I'm thinking in my head, this is our year. This is our year. This is when we're going to win it all. And we run into this buzzsaw of a hot Warriors team who had Coach Nelson, who was our coach there. And he knew exactly all of our weaknesses and my weaknesses. And he exploited all of them. And so we ended up losing to the Warriors in the first round. We were the first one seed at the time to lose in a 7-game series. And I got to say that year I was more disappointed than losing the finals in 06 because I had such high hopes. We were the team to beat. I got to say I didn't leave my house for about 2 weeks. I felt I let my team down. I felt like I let the city down, the franchise. And that was probably as frustrated as I was in my career and disappointed and just a gut punch. And that took me a while to get over. The 06, like I said, I was okay in my head. I'm like, oh, we'll be here every year now. But the 07 year really ripped my heart out there for a while. And that took me a while to recover. And I wanted to leave town as soon as possible, get away as far as possible. And the NBA calls you like, you got to stick around. There's actually a chance you get in the MVP. And I'm like, I don't even want it. You know, just keep this thing. I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, so then I had to stick around for like 10 days, 2 weeks in Dallas to wait. Because as you know, back in the days, they presented the MVP trophy during the second round, the middle of the second round. So I had to wait. I had to wait in Dallas and not leave my house and just be frustrated every day. And then I got the MVP. And I remember doing that press conference. I was dreading. And then I was able to leave the country after that. But man, that was a super, super tough summer. And I took that one harder than I did the 06 finals loss.
That's what made 11 so much better. I mean, it's one thing to win a championship, but to go through those things, because I remember it, you know, well, and I was on the air with it. Because you were different, you were soft. Because you didn't win, it was only because you were soft. And then that stuff just bothers me because it's so dismissive. And I knew you weren't soft. You know, like I knew... You were battling it with guys all the time. And then it was like, oh, now he's not soft anymore. You know, and it's all bullshit. It's all playing the results. Look, some guys are soft and some guys aren't. I never thought that of you. But because you're, you know, a tall white Euro, it's like, oh, well, he must be soft because those are the rules. And you beat a Heat team that's the favorite, that is arguably, you know, one of the best groupings that we've ever seen in the prime. How were you able to beat them? What was it about you beating this team that everybody felt like they were picking?
Well, I think we were a little fortunate, and I got to say that was their first year that they were together. I think if you remember, you know, LeBron and Wade and Bosh, they were still trying to figure out how they play with each other, who's taking the big shots, how are they defining their roles. And so I think there was still some question marks in their own minds how this is all going to work. And so I think we snuck in there at the right time. You know, obviously they were way more talented than us. I think we had a group that had great chemistry. We knew our roles. We knew who was the defender, our defenders were. We knew where we were going when we needed a big bucket. So we were just a really tight unit at the time, and we had a great group, and we were just skilled enough, honestly, to overcome their skill level and just battling together and getting some key stops when we needed to. And we're able to grind it out. But we were fortunate. If we would have run into them in year two or maybe year three of them together, I think it would have been a different outcome. But, you know, fortunate for us, we didn't have to worry about that. And we saw them in year one when they just came together, and that was our time. So just, you know, making them work, making LeBron and Dwayne try to make things tough on them, and on the offensive end, move the ball. They were so athletic. They closed out to our shooters so fast that I think the first two games we were kind of overwhelmed. We were like in the first couple rounds, we had all these good looks and open shots, and things were going well. And then all of a sudden, these guys were so athletic on the perimeter. I mean, our shooters couldn't even get really in the game. So it was tough, but we figured out some ways where we could get our shots, and we were able to beat them, which was obviously made 06 and 07 kind of worth it. You know, for me to go through the lowest of the low and fight through those times and keep working hard, and that motivated me to push harder. And then to finally, you know, get to the top, that made it even sweeter. And all these disappointments I used as fuel and work hard to get better. So that made 11, of course, that much sweeter.
Just two quick things as we finish up. Did you feel that because it took a long time for the NBA to accept you, and then, you know, just all the shit you took because of 06 and then 07, because you're right, the Warriors thing was brutal for you, and then you got to wait around, and then everybody wants to, after you win 67 games, like, oh, this guy shouldn't even be the MVP, and you're like, all right, well, that's ridiculous. But then everybody felt like they liked you. You know, winning can cure a lot of things, but did you feel then like, hey, I've been an all-star now for a decade, and now I have my ring, that did you feel it? Did you feel like all of a sudden now everybody loved Dirk, and that even other superstars appreciated and you respected you more as a contemporary than prior to those years?
I did feel a lot more respect, even from when I came to the All-Star game the next year, even the media. I don't know. It was a different respect level. I think it gave me a lot of confidence too, walking around my peers. I think it took a lot of weight off my shoulders because I was always disappointed every year. And maybe I'm not good enough to get us over the top. And then when you get there, though, it's like this sense of pride, this sense of satisfaction. You know, now what? Now what can you say? I think I've had some of that. And if I got to say, it felt good. It felt good the next couple of years to go to the All-Star games and there's not much you can say about me now. I did deliver. So I got to say that was a very proud moment for myself, of course.
It wasn't just your footwork, your height, you know, the quickness in your movements, which is different than just end-to-end speed. The thing I always thought was amazing about you, and you can tell me if this is part of the secret or not, I always felt like as a shooter, your base could be a mess. Your feet could be wrong. Your hips could be your shoulders could not even be square, but it was always the same out of your hands, that it was always the same release at the top. And even though no one would look at the rest of it and say, hey, it's okay to have this all, you know, you had times where it's totally in line, but even when you were totally out of alignment, your hands and your fingers were always the same. And I don't know that I've seen a lot of guys ever do it that way.
So I think you want to start by having a good balance, and that I don't want to have young kids now starting to shoot like that. You have to learn the basics first. And I did, of course, hundreds of thousands of reps to get to the point where I was comfortable shooting all these the shots. So that's obviously the work you don't see. But you're right. Once I was getting a little older and had all the experience, I felt like with my height and with my touch, that I could always get a good look up. No matter end of the shot clock, I'm kind of spinning. If I just get a quick lean back and I just get a quick glimpse of the basket, I still had a good shot or had a good chance of making a shot. And that's part because I had to get my elbow square. I think that's important. I always had needed my elbow to go towards the rim. And then the rest was just natural to me. It was, I've done it a million times. And so it's really all I needed. It was a split second and just a little bit of separation from my defender. And I felt like no matter how my body was torqued, I was getting, once my elbow was in the right position, my fingers were on my elbow, my follow through would do the rest. So you're right. It's a lot of work that goes in. And a lot of, you know, I started shooting with Holger when I was like 15 years old. So, you know, that's a lot of work you put in. And every day we worked on my shots. Even when I was in my 30s and 40s, every day I got to the gym, I started, you know, up close and you shoot a couple 5-6 footers and you work on your touch. And so you don't go in the gym and you see me shooting a one-legged fadeaway. You know, that's not how I start. Every day you need to work on your skill level and polish your shot and work on certain things to obviously get to the outcome where you can shoot all sorts of shots.
The book is The Great Nowitzki, Basketball and the Meaning of Life by Thomas Pletzinger. And Dirk, it has been a blast. It's great to catch up with you again. And good luck with the book. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yes, good to see you. And thanks for helping out.
This episode is brought to you by Hulu Plus Live TV. Looking for a better way to watch live TV? Stream your favorite sports and shows on over 95 live channels with Hulu Plus Live TV. Get access to Hulu's entire streaming library, Disney Plus and ESPN Plus, all in one plan. Start your free trial of Hulu Plus Live TV today. Live TV plan required. Restrictions apply. Access content from each service separately. Learn more at Hulu.com. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card.
you earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
You want details? Fine. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Life advice, rr at gmail. Welcome in, everyone. Kyle, good to have you back, buddy. How was the vacation?
It was the best. It was just the best. It was cold, but it was still the best.
All right. I like hearing that. Positive stuff here to get the week started. Although we're now on a Tuesday-Thursday schedule, so we weren't able to check in with Kyle soon enough. Let's get to it. Bill and I started up the Sunday pods. That's why we're back on Tuesday-Thursdays. And I would say that I appreciate Kyle forwarding me some of these things because it's become a thing now where people can't tell if these little one-liners that I throw in the Bill pods are on purpose, if Bill hates them, if Bill doesn't get them. I swear to God, I feel like we get more reaction on these than almost anything else I say in those hour and a half, 2 hour pods. I know what I'm doing, and I think Bill knows what I'm doing, and I don't think he hates it. I just don't think he cares. And we just go right over him. I think there's maybe a few times he doesn't get him, but I'll be like so kind of quick under my breath with him. I'm not exactly setting it up for this laugh track either. When we brought up Andrew Bynum, and I said he works out at my gym, which some were accusing of a name drop. I was just telling you, the guy's still around, walking around, saying hi to people, and he's really nice. Because I think Andrew Bynum is a guy that's really easy to forget, so I just kind of threw that in there. I don't think anybody goes, you know what, I was kind of on the fence about Russillo, but he said he saw Andrew Bynum at his gym. I think that guy's fucking awesome. I don't expect that to happen. I don't think anyone's ever said that about me or would put those two things together and say, hear about Russillo? Fucking ran into Bynum like 2 years ago at Equinox. That guy's just killing it, huh? So I don't think that would happen. So yeah, I don't think Bill cares. I don't think Bill addresses him. But a lot of people are kind of it's not a big mystery, you know, but I'm going to keep doing them. So there you go.
You know what I would say about the little ones is sometimes we go on Zooms and you can't really hear so much, especially if it's the classic Russillo brand, like under the breath thing. Sometimes he might not even hear it. And I'll be like, oh, Russillo said something there. I wonder what it is. I'll find out later when we get the mic audio. So sometimes if it's like a real low one, we'll just find out when we hear the mic version.
Little future Russillo nuggets. Yeah, I think Bill is just kind of like, he knows you're having fun. So he's like, I'll let Russillo get his few quicks out. And then, but he's got bigger things to fry. Like he's talking about expansion and stuff. He's like, we got to move on. So he keeps the pace going, but he lets you drop these things in there. I think he enjoys it, but I don't think he wants to dwell on it for long. So I think it's good.
I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but I think you're right. I think he's like,
he appeases you.
Yeah.
He's just like, all right, I'll let Russillo get a couple of zingers out doing. There and make him feel good about himself.
Look, I know he hates the long stories. I mean, that's been established. My point would be like on the Jimmy Chitwood thing. I don't actually think I was Jimmy Chitwood in high school. And I'm like, hey, we're doing like 90 plus minutes on Hoosiers. I think I can explore the space here for like 4 or 5 minutes. I think we're okay. I think we'll all be all right. And that's usually a pretty dividing line, because if you really like Bill, then you hate that I do those. And then if you like me, you think it's hilarious. And so or maybe you don't think it's hilarious. I don't know. I just figure in the 90 minutes to 2 hours, I'm like, yeah, like, you know, just kind of let something fly. But no, he doesn't seem to enjoy him all that much. So we'll just keep it moving. Just like one of those segments. All right. Okay. We got a couple different ones here. I'm looking forward to them. All right. I failed my first interview for college newspaper. Okay. This guy's throwing his name out there, which we're not going to do to you. 5'7", 190. 570 would be a weird way to list your height. I don't lift as much, so I'm trying to get back to my normal weight at 150. Okay. Anyway, aspiring sports writer enrolled at a D1 program. It's not a major program, but they're D1 and everything. All right. So this is a big deal. I write articles for the school newspaper covering games, writing stories. I was assigned by my editor a story covering baseball team captains. This is my first time interviewing players for a story. And boy, could this interview not go any worse. First part, I forgot about the interview entirely. Okay, not great. I had it marked on my calendar, but still forgot as I was at my full-time job at the time of the interview and was greeted to a few emails and calls from the PR lady, which weren't exactly pleasant.
I mean, all right, fair.
She just missed it.
Yeah.
No one, I'll tell you this, no one loves that in the business. People aren't huge fans of that. Second, I could not connect to the meeting. And when I did, I was totally unprepared and asked questions that left the players confused. They were probably laughing at me. Ha ha.
Okay.
He threw in his own ha ha about them laughing at him, I believe. So I'm assuming this is a Zoom issue. It does happen. It's happened to us. It's happened with me trying to connect to somebody for something. And it's also happened to, you know, people that we had booked to do some stuff. And it does happen. Usually you're able to get through it, though. I would say over 90% of the time you come up with some kind of solution.
It's like your Brandon Marshall interview.
Wait, when we had the wrong Brandon Marshall?
Yeah, you just kind of did it on the fly, asked some questions, you made it work.
That was horrifying. That was
quick on your toes.
Yeah. I don't. If they ever do a thing on me one day and be like, you know, he had his strong points. He could have been better here. You know, some people really liked him, others didn't quite get him. But maybe his peak was in the middle of seeing Brandon Marshall on Zoom going, that's not the Brandon Marshall we thought we booked.
What's it like being away from your team? I remember that was one of your questions.
Yeah.
We had no idea where.
What's been going on, man? What's good with you?
I just picture like the Zillow radio podcast Hall of Fame case. And it's like, yeah, you know, he was on a couple shows, kind of, you know, number two to Vin Pelt for a few years there. But like there was that one Brandon Marshall and he just nailed that. Like, could anybody else in the industry do that? You're in the pantheon of incredible interviews because of that.
Yeah. And look, it went well. He was terrific. And once I started, thank God I remembered him because I liked him a lot as a linebacker with Denver. I'm like, wait, okay, hold on. And now some people could be Broncos people like, how could you have forgotten? Trust me, that's a pretty niche lane, especially when all the emails, by the way, were pitching the receiver.
Yes.
All right. So this
wasn't
like
a bad job reading. Yeah.
No, this wasn't like we screwed it up. All of us on our end thought we were getting the receiver. We were pitched him. We said yes. We were good to go. No offense to the linebacker. But when he popped up on the Zoom, I'm like, what the fuck is going on in my head? And I'm just like, all right, let's go.
He ended up being good. And you guys are boys now, kind of.
Yeah. We hit it off. We were cool. I don't think we followed up a ton since then. But yeah, I think, I appreciate
that was one of the more fun days I've had. I felt like I was like at a sleepover and we just like broke the chair upstairs. It's like, I was like, whoa, what are we going to do? It worked out.
What an incredible analogy by Kyle. Okay. All right. So our guy doesn't show up. Then when he does connect, can't really connect, was unprepared, asked bad questions. 3, connection failed. Again, and I had to ask the PR lady. I hope you didn't call her PR lady. If I can reschedule the interview. Instead, she conducted the interview for me after I texted her some questions. What do I do? Has anything like this ever happened to you during your career at college? In college, I would have definitely missed a million interviews, but I also wasn't nearly motivated enough to be involved in student newspaper, radio station, any of those things. I remember my father would be like, hey, do you think maybe you should look into any of this stuff? I'm like, oh, dude, don't worry about it. I'll get to it. So credit to you for at least being a little bit more motivated. I feel so embarrassed. I think I'm going to be known as the guy who doesn't take his craft serious. Why do you think people would say that, dude?
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Please help. Is there any way I can recover from this? Will the players be able to take me seriously going forward? Or am I totally overthinking this situation? Nobody's even thinking about it the way that I am. Well, I hope nobody else is thinking about the way you are. I hope for you it's a bit of a wake-up call to go, look, whatever you need to do, if you're bad at scale, you have to figure it out. You have to get better at that stuff. Because if you don't get better at that stuff, then it's going to be a really tough industry for you. Here's the thing I think I have the biggest problem with. Technical shit happens. But if you knew you had to interview these players, then why were you not prepared with questions? Like, why did the technical part of this, why did all of these things happen where you weren't ready? Was it because you weren't ready because you completely forgot when the interview was actually going to happen and you were going to wait until the last minute to prep the interview? Because that's something that you're going to have to get better at in general. So I could tell you to be on it more and schedule. I don't know you. Maybe you fucked stuff like this up all the time. Maybe this is a one-off and it doesn't really matter. What I would tell you to make you feel a little bit better is that a bunch of college baseball players probably aren't going to remember the guy that did a bad interview from the college newspaper. Because no offense to the college newspaper people out there, you're just not going to be seasoned enough as an interviewer at this point that you're going to stand out. And actually, if you ask like super complicated questions that were trying to be like a little Charlie Rose show off from the student newspaper, that might make you stand out because you'd be like, what's up with this person? So I would get over that part because they've probably already gotten over it. I would reach out to the PR person. I would go in person, okay? I would go seek her out. I would sit her down and say, I've embarrassed myself. I completely fucked this up. And it was a big wake-up call. And if there's anything I can do to prove it to you that this is important to me, let me know what I can do, whatever I need to do. Because if it is important to you, then you have to take that step. If it isn't important to you, then you don't have to do any of those stuff. Problem solved. But it sounds like this is important to you. It's amazing what people will do with that face-to-face interaction where, you know, look, you can solve a lot of problems. You can solve a lot of problems by you showing that you care enough to take out the time. And it's actually not that hard. And it is very simple. And if you come off as sincere and you seem decent enough in person, you're not an asshole, this can actually work out for you. And maybe it's just a little bit of a lesson and you'll remember this. And it's great that it happened to you so early when not as much was on the line with all of this. So that's the other part of it. So I wouldn't worry about the player part, but I would say in the future, you never know. You know, you never know when you're going to be, you know, there's times where I can still not feel as prepared as I need to be. But I'm guessing you weren't prepared here because you didn't know about the interview. And when you finally got connected, you were like, I didn't even know I'd be doing this today. If it's a habit where you're not prepared for interviews in general, then I would ask why you're even doing this. But I'm assuming it's the first part of it. So don't beat yourself up forever. It's not the end of the world, but make the steps that are necessary go above and beyond to fix this, because I would like to think at the college level, everyone's a little bit more accepting, even though it's so competitive. And there's probably a bunch of other people that love to be even given this chance. So don't screw it up again.
I agree. It's like that's the time where you get to make those mistakes and hopefully they stick with you. And sometimes you make them after they're like, you know, I remember I drove my mom's truck one time, she would lend it to me, and there was like the transmission light went on, and I just kept fucking driving it for like the rest of the day until I couldn't drive it anymore, and I was like, ma, something's wrong. So like, that's one of those things where it's like, you'll never forget that. When the light goes on, stop. You fail a class in college, you know, or you fail two classes, and then you get that wake up, whatever. This is a part where you learn those lessons, and thank God you didn't have to do it at your job. Like, now if you do end up with that job, you'll manically check your calendar, your Google Calendar thing, and keep it. Like, that's just one of those things. There's just a million ways that you can say I learned a lesson for something, but you sound like you're a little sick to your stomach about it and you're wondering what to do. And you'll never forget that. You know, your editor could have told you, you know, could have warned you about all this stuff and basically taught you that lesson without you having to go through it. But it probably wouldn't have stuck in your brain, and you'll never forget this. So I think actually it's probably great that if you do end up in this career, you've got this embarrassing, messed up thing out of the way now.
I do like that Kyle found just a sliver of a chance of maybe blaming somebody else here too.
Well, what do you mean?
He's like, maybe the editor.
No, I'm saying if your editor was like, hey, never, if you just said, not this, but like if, when you start, he's like, hey, never be late for anything, never miss it. Like, he's trying to tell you the rules and how not to mess it up. Like, that wouldn't have stuck in your brain until you actually screwed it up and like, you know, kind of, you know, were unprepared and felt awful giving this interview that everyone involved knows sucks.
Right.
I think if it makes you feel better, like maybe cover a different sport next time, just kind of avoid that altogether. But at the end of the day, like I went to communication school, I took some journalism classes, and there are definitely some people that I went to school with who are now successful in the business, who are reporters, big network anchors, whatever, who didn't have their shit together in college. And I'd be like, wow, that person ended up like kind of making it work. So I wouldn't worry about one screw up. Like, yeah, it's embarrassing in the moment, but it doesn't really matter long term. But you guys said the most important part. It's just a wake up, and it makes you on edge for future things. So this one thing isn't going to ruin your career. But I think, you know, kind of figure out how to be better if you really want to do this thing. And I think that's just kind of the wake up call you needed.
Yeah. By the way, people will still fuck up things. Like, I've still fucked up stuff. You know, I remember a couple times where it was just like, you know, I screwed up the schedule. You know what I mean? Like it's not like it never, like no one has ever done it. It's just bad when it's your first impression. And some of the email I'm a little worried about, like, okay, do you fully understand what you need to do here? But yeah, I can't emphasize this enough. There's so much value on when you do screw up, show up, get your ass kicked a little bit.
Own it.
Yeah. And, you know, then don't argue. You're like, hey, I screwed up. Okay, well, here's your, well, this is where I see, I think you're wrong. Like, no, you're the one that screwed up. You're going to have to take some stuff. You may even hear some stuff that you don't even want to hear. You may hear stuff that you think, oh, this is actually inaccurate. That's not the time to fight that fight. All right, another email here. I will repeat a story I know I've told before. Audience is growing, though. So these are some of those radio sort of slash podcast rules. They used to tell us this kind of stuff. It would be like 70% of the audience was in the last 6 months. I never quite believed all that stuff, but I think it was a way for people to kind of forgive you for being repetitive. Because when you were talking, at least on radio, 15 hours a week for that many years, like stuff's going to get repeated. And I know there's certain little lessons or stuff that I can tell at times. I'm like, I know I've told this before, but I think I will repeat some of this stuff just because of the life advice part alone and how, you know, just know there's more of an audience now. So our guy's checking in about pursuing stand-up comedy, 57145, short guy. Thank you for confirming. Anyway, I work in the news industry in North Carolina, but I just accepted a bigger job in New York City. I'm very excited about it, not only for the professional advancement aspect, but to finally escape my hometown and try a different lifestyle. I've been looking at jobs in the city because I really want to hit open mics and try my hand at stand-up comedy. I don't love the corporate America grind, and part of me wants to do it because I fantasize about being able to hit the road and travel to comedy clubs around the country for a living, even if that means not making a ton of money. I work in news now, so I'm used to living average at best. I don't think I'll ever be the guy who isn't sure if he should buy a Ferrari because it could create bad vibes with his wife. All right, so we're talking about financially, you're not worried about any of these things because of, you know, wherever you're at. Cool. Got it. All right. I've done some open mics around town, college. It went well. I was always the funny guy, the friend group. But I know to be super funny and build a career, you have to be pretty much all in on stand-up comedy. Fortunately, I have a solid job to always fall back on. But like I said, I think the blue collar lifestyle of a comedian, the potential of being that guy from the small North Carolina town that blew up, excites me more than anything. Now he's very excited about this. I'm going to leave out why he's super excited about life on the road, as you guys can probably figure that one out on your own. Basically, I want to be a stand-up comic, but I'm afraid of failure and feel my expectations may be too high. They are. Any advice you guys have that would be helpful for navigating this whole situation, managing expectations, mindset, pursuing this as a career? Okay. Well, first of all, I'm always going to tell anybody that is feeling these things to go for it. I just am. Unfortunately, there's also a real part of this where we all don't get to live out our dreams, but it doesn't mean you can't try, because I think never trying would be worse than failing. I really, truly believe that. And as I know back to my early days, which started almost exactly 20 years ago now, and when I was still kind of leading up to it, bartending and doing all this different stuff and telling people about my dreams and my goals, there was almost no one that's supportive, okay? There's almost no one that tells you to go for it. Almost no one believes in you. And I definitely think men are tougher with each other on this stuff than females are. There were certainly a couple people in my family that believed in me, so that was very important. But at that point, I didn't really care. Like, I wasn't going to listen to anybody, because I do think this is another part of this where I would tell you older people that maybe have taken the non-traditional path to success will tell you that when you're younger and you're telling people about some of your dreams and some of the stuff that you try to do, and again, like, I had a John Morant monologue today, all right? That's not being a stand-up comedy star. That's not being an actor, actress, writer, musician. Like, shit, that's really, really cool, man. That stuff, I'm constantly, like, I will respect the hell out of you for even trying that stuff, because I know how hard it can be for so many different people that are trying. So when I would get bad advice, I started to realize, and maybe I didn't even realize it in the moment, it was probably more as I got, you know, more perspective and had a few years into what I was doing, it was like I was getting bad advice, not because the person thought it was a bad idea for me necessarily, even though the odds are kind of stacked against you, like we said in the very beginning of this whole thing. A lot of the bad advice and the pessimism that you get is because that person didn't try and they don't want to see you succeed for trying something they never had the balls to try in the first place. And that is a absolute fact of life. So once you get past that, you're like, well, why would I listen to this fucking person? Like, do they really care about me? Now, maybe the person that really cares about you, a sister, a brother, mother, father, maybe a really close relative, maybe your best friend is just your guy. Maybe they're pessimistic because they know how hard it is and they don't want you to struggle and go through all those things. But I still think going through life in the first third of your professional life, whatever that time frame is for you, it's not the same for everyone. I knew that if I did kind of the normal things that I would have something gnawing at me forever. And it was the same way why, you know, when I ended up leaving ESPN, even though I wish I'd shut the fuck up about the writing thing, I knew there was just something gnawing at me. There was like, I have to try to take this chance. Now, as far as how likely it is, I mean, you mentioned that you're the bar is set way too high for yourself. Well, why not? Who cares? What do you want to introduce yourself as a guy? Like, I hope to be average. You know, I hope to get jokes off that people laugh at like 40% of the time. I mean, why not be hard on yourself? I mean, you already know how hard this is going to be. And then you're going to have to kind of calculate your own level of discouragement. Like, do you get easily discouraged? Are you going to have a show if you do a stand up and nobody fucking laughs? Are you going to go, I don't want to do this? Because it's going to happen. And it's not just about being funny, even though I don't really understand that much about it. But I think you start to realize the people that are really successful, it's the way they set it up, and then kind of pay it off. They learn the rhythm, the beats. They get their thousands of hours in. They know exactly how to read a crowd. Their timing is incredible. And it's not just, hey, I talked to my therapist yesterday. You know what I mean? Like the people, and again, my taste will be different than your taste. Funny can be very subjective. But I mean, that's the hours that you're going to have to put in and the times you feel like it's going nowhere. I mean, very rare is anyone that does any of these special things where they're just such a gifted person that they're so natural that immediately they're getting results. It just doesn't really happen. And so I'm telling you right now, much like anything that I've tried to pursue, I mean, shit, the traditional stuff can be discouraging, never mind the non-traditional stuff. But there are going to be moments where you want to quit all the time. And that's the point. That's why it is so hard. That's why people were so pessimistic about it. That's why some people would discourage you. Throughout the process, because you're going to have times like I remember sitting in my car being broke, being like, fuck this. I'm watching all these games. And I can fucking rub two 20s together. Like, what's the point? And then I'd be like, what are you going to do? You're going to do something normal? Because you're not going to like that either. So you might as well just do this stuff. So I'm going to leave you with a story on this because if whoever's listening to this, you either don't get any of this and you think, hey, what's wrong with you guys? Why can't you get out of your own head? Which, by the way, you might be right. But for the other people that feel like they have this creative thing and that's going on, it's inside them, you just kind of know, right? You just kind of know and you either get past it or it just keeps growing and it's gnawing and there's just nothing you could do and you have to feed it and you have to figure it out, right? You got to get your answers to these thoughts that are in your head of like, can I actually do this? Because I think it's hard. I think it's hard to tell your friends, hey, I'm going to do these things because I saw it all firsthand. But one of my favorite stories, freshman year at UVM, I've told it to some already, so please forgive me for being repetitive about it, but I just think it's an important story because I'll never forget it. Freshman year, guy we're in school with, loved him to death, great guy, a lot of fun, loved to have a good time. But when he got drunk, all he wanted to do was do karaoke by himself at a dive bar that none of us ever wanted to go to and none of us could even get into. But he had like the best idea out of everybody. So he could get in his freshman year and he would come up and he'd be like, Priscilla, let's go do karaoke. And I'd be like, I don't want to go with you ever to do that, ever. It's never fun. It's never a good time. No one can ever get in there. No one's in there that we'd ever want to talk to. And he would just Irish goodbye it. And we'd be like, where is he? Be like, I don't know. I think he went to JP's again. And we would be leaving our little place that we could get into. And we'd be walking back up the campus, another cold Vermont winter night, freezing our asses off with one guy in his yellow North Face, and the other guy in his red one, somebody in their black one, and mountain jacket, whatever, vents on the side, NBD. Still have mine from 94. Just can't throw it away. And we'd peek in the window. And there he'd be in his little yellow North Face singing Hank Williams. And we would just laugh. And at the end of the year, we had some end of the year meeting, our fraternity. And he was like, hey guys, I loved it here, but I got to transfer to Vanderbilt. I got to go to Nashville. Music's in my heart. I have to pursue this. And we were like, we're like, are you serious, dude? It was the least supportive group of any people ever assembled in one room. And that guy's Dierks Bentley. I mean, he transferred to Vandy. He's been nominated for a bunch of Grammys. He sold millions and millions of records. He knew he had something inside of him that was driving him crazy that he needed to figure it out. And he did. And it's one of my favorite stories of my entire life. It's inspiring. And he just didn't give a shit. He just didn't give a shit. He looked at a room of like 40 to 50 guys between 18 and 22 years old that all laughed in his face. They just laughed at him. Not one guy was like, awesome idea, dude. Great plan. What people didn't realize
is that,
also, right, that he was also brilliant and he got into Vandy like that. They were like, no problem. And he just didn't give a shit because he knew no matter what, that's what he was going to do. He's like, I'm going to do this and whatever. And it doesn't mean everybody's going to turn into the next big country star or the next big comedian or even people that want to pursue sports. But you'll kind of know. You'll kind of know inside of yourself where you'll go, this is driving me so crazy that I have to figure this out about myself. Or you'll just kind of get over it and go, you know what? I actually don't need all that shit. Because it isn't always a blast, man. It isn't. But you know what? There's a lot of other things that are normal that are a lot easier to pursue that aren't always a blast too. So what would you rather do?
I agree. And I think for like stand-ups, oh my bad, I was muted. And I think for like stand-ups, isn't it like you can't tour if it's this guy, you can't like be a road guy unless people, other stops down the road want you, right? So you basically have to do it at night. In like, you know, wherever you can get up on stage, right? I mean, this is, the stakes are pretty low for this for a while until you're like, oh shit, it's actually going to start cutting into my, you know, into my job. And I'm going to have to wonder if I can do my job. Like you're allowed to do these steps because he's going to move, right? That's his
thing. if you're going to be in New York City, this is actually very easy to pull off. There's going to be a bunch of places that I'm sure you could probably just, you know, I don't think you're going to be outside of the Comedy Cellar next week. All right. But just being around it, I would think would be inspiring. You know, sometimes when you have this idea of what you may want to do, at the very least, like being around it. You know, I remember I went to go like sit in and watch a radio station. And honestly, after I got done with that day, I was like, I don't want to do this. Okay. but just being around it. And then, you know, you're going to get up and nobody's going to laugh at you. And you're going to either be motivated by the challenge or you're going to be so horrified you never want to do it again. But at least you'll have answered some of those questions. And that's what I think is always really cool about this stuff. I mean, I don't look, maybe we should have a comedian on and ask them about this, like the getting started and all that stuff. I'm sure there's horror stories. I'm sure there's parts of it that aren't a lot of fun. But I'm sure once you get past a certain point, you look back on it and you're like, you know, the iron sharpens iron stuff where you start to figure some stuff out. Maybe we'll pitch some jokes at Barkazi again. Have him on.
He loved that. That'd be great.
That was so well the first time. Yeah. I actually have a cousin who is a stand-up comedian in LA. Plug. And Matt Chimber. He's good. He's really funny. Grew up like small town Connecticut like me. He was always funny growing up. And he always, I don't know if he ever like always wanted to do this, but it's something that like kind of like it was an itch that he had. And so he went to LA. He's an architect, like had a full-time architecture job, like a good job, and he would just do clubs on the side for a while, for years. And honestly, Twitter and really Instagram like blowing up, like he does like skit videos now, which he's got a ton of followers, and I think that probably helped him. I mean, like Ryan, you'll appreciate this, like he's done shows, and I think he's boys with like the Chad Goes Deep guys, so he's like in decent circles, but it took him a while to get to that point and meet all these relationships. I mean, it's kind of like a, it's sort of a networking thing, like you meet people on shows, and now he does travel. You know, he's not doing like, you know, arenas or anything like that, but he's doing big stuff. He's been at the Laugh Factory in LA, and it was like a very slow burn for him. And he was doing small stuff for free, stuff on social media, just to kind of get his name out there. And, you know, I don't know if his goal is like to be a full-time comedian. It might be, he's still an architect now, but like, it is a grind and you have to basically know that going in. Like I remember in college when, you know, all these people, like we were like talking about journalism classes, right? People want to be on air. They want to be reporters. Right. And one of the things that one of my professors said, which I'm glad that they said, because it was like the most important thing was like, this isn't a glamorous thing at the start. Like you're going to make 25, maybe even less grand a year for years trying to be like a local anchor in like Des Moines, Iowa or something. And that really like weeds out who really wants the job and who doesn't. A lot of people are just like, yeah, I'm just going to finish out my degree and I'm going to go into sales once I'm done. But there were the few people that did stick out and, you know, pursued their dreams of being an on-air anchor. And I'm, you know, I know people at major news networks now. So it just depends on like what you're willing to put in and how the work you're willing to put in early on when it's probably going to be pretty shitty. And I know you know that, but like just know that that grind is really, really hard. And it's not for everybody. Some people want to just like have a life where they, you know, make some money quickly, they start a family and everything is kind of like, you know, it's just comfortable, right? And they're comfortable and there's really no risk taking. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But you have to know in your heart that you're willing to kind of take on those challenges and have there be hard times and grind for a while. And that's not for everybody. I think one of the most important things is knowing whether or not you're that person or not.
And it's not binary either, right? It's not like either you quit your job. It's not like all the comedy clubs are like, oh shit, Mark just quit his job. We got to get him in here next week. Like, that's not how it works. So you can do both for, I mean, at least the foreseeable future until it's actually a real conflict of work and comedy. So,
and by the way, that's supposedly what you want, right? Like, that's the good problem. That's the problem. Like, hey, this is starting to pick up so much. Now I have some, but to be in New York City, to have a job already and to have all of these opportunities, I'm not saying like the highest profile places, but going to see other people, studying other people, and then trying your own stuff out and trying different spots here and there. And there's going to be an audience that maybe vibes with you, and there's going to be plenty that don't. And then you're going to start learning about yourself. You know, that's when like the growing up really happens. You start to go, oh, all right. You know, because I have always, you know, Sarudi was touching on this a little bit before. I know the way I was programmed about what I wanted. But I also know that when I would talk to, you know, people that weren't on the air that I became friendly with, let's say at ESPN, right? And I would kind of go, you know, hey, did you ever want to do something different and whatever? And they go, you know what? Maybe when I was younger. And then I realized, like, what you do, I don't want to have to do that. Every day I got to have something to say. If I'm in a terrible mood, who cares? The red light's on. Entertain us for 3 hours. All knowing the stress of maybe saying the wrong thing that day ends your fucking career. You know? Can you imagine, like, the days where I have something going on in my personal life, and then it's like, hey, do you have a John Moran open for us today? You know, not that this is that hard, but that's why I don't look at myself versus somebody who decided to go in a different path. Like, I'll constantly go, maybe they were right. You know, I know what was right for me, but I'm not going to say that person's wrong. So,
yeah, I remember doing that when I did the Daily Show with Scout, right? That ended up not working out. I didn't really actually like it as much as I thought I would. I'm glad that I tried it. It didn't work out. I didn't grow up like wanting to be an on-air person, but I was like, you know what? I should just scratch the itch, try it, figure it out. And I actually didn't really love doing a show 5 days. Maybe you'll find that out. Maybe you'll find out you don't really like doing it. But you don't know that until you try it. So go for it and do your thing. But before we move on, I actually got a question for you, because did you ever do karaoke with Dierks Bentley? Like, I can't see you as a karaoke guy at all.
I could never get into that bar.
But I couldn't even see you doing karaoke once. Like, I could just see you being like, nah, I'm Ryan. I don't do karaoke.
No, I mean, a couple Coors Lights in me. I've been known to do some Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash? Okay. That was going to be my next question.
Yeah. No, when I was younger, I did it a couple times.
It's really heavy, though.
Real showstopper.
You doing like Hurt by yourself at some bar?
No, we did we used to do this thing where my buddy would get a van and we would go to like every weird dive bar we could find in the outskirts of Burlington. So we wouldn't go to any of our regular stuff. We'd go to all these other places that we would never, ever normally go to. And honestly, it was one of the most fun things we ever did. And then we just, you know, we'd get banged up and we'd do karaoke and then we'd go in the next place or whatever. I mean, usually by the end of the night, people, we'd get some real outskirts places where we were like, were we just going to get jumped here or what? But, usually most of the guys we were with are pretty big, so it wasn't going to happen. Nice. But no, it's been, there's a karaoke spot near me up here. I did go with somebody and she absolutely showstopper. She just, I'm not going to share who it was. But she just knocked out of the park. There's some guy who did like a 13 minute. I'm not even going to say, cause it's sort of a signature move.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to be sharing secrets, but there's a guy who did like a 13 minute Doors song. 13 minutes.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
No.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah. He was incredible, but
still crazy.
You know, some people are just there for tacos too, you know? So, all right. That was Life Advice. Hit us up. LifeAdviceRR@gmail.com. Great pod today. Really fired up. Hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe. Ringer at Spotify. Thanks to Kyle and Steve.
This episode is brought to you by UGG. Y'all know UGG is a brand that athletes wear all the time in the tunnel and on travel days. Well, I bet you think UGG season is only during the colder months of the year. Au contraire, you're wrong. You need to check out the latest spring drop from UGG, They have everything from sandals to clogs. I like the sandals. UGG has you covered for your next spring adventure. Shop the Golden Collection at UGG.com.